A few years ago, in the wake of the success of the podcast Serial, a renaissance of true crime stories emerged. And one of the most popular wrongful conviction stories that leapt onto the scene and captured our imagination in 2015 was Making a Murderer. It wasn't a podcast, though. It was a documentary series that premiered on Netflix. And the filmmakers had spent 10 years filming and chronicling the conviction of Stephen Avery for the 2005 murder of Teresa Halbach.
The people that were close to Steve knew he was always happy, happy, happy. Always wanted to make other people laugh.
They didn't dress like everybody else. They didn't have education like other people. The Avery family didn't fit into the community.
Stevie did do a lot of stupid things, but he always owned up to everything he did wrong.
I've been a good life.
Now, Avery's story was compelling because prior to these charges, he had already been exonerated after spending 18 years in prison for a sexual assault he did not commit. Not unlike Serial, the series launched a worldwide debate about the innocence or guilt of the defendant, part of that debate hinging on the statements and confession of his nephew, Brendan Dassey. Brendan was 16 years old at the time. And not only did his confession incriminate himself, it also incriminated his uncle. But unlike Stephen Avery, the figure of Brendan Dassey did not prompt a massive debate, because nearly across the board, people who saw the series were appalled at the footage of a clearly confused young boy being manipulated into making statements he nearly immediately retracted on camera to his mother.
Yeah, but I got a question.
What's that?
What happened if he says something? Like, his story is different, but he says he admits to it doing it.
What do you mean?
Like, if his story is like different, like, I never did nothing or something.
Did you? Huh?
Not really.
What do you mean, not really?
It's an interrogation you have to see to believe. But Brendan was convicted in 2007 along with his uncle, and a lot has happened in his case since then, and since the documentary itself aired. And most recently, it seems like the Supreme Court might take a look at the case. Now joining me today are two guests who will fill us in on this case and help us understand the broader issues that are at play here. Welcome to Undisclosed. This week we are bringing a special bonus episode to talk all about the Brendan Dassey case. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an author and attorney, and this week I have the pleasure of speaking with attorneys Stephen Drizin and Laura Nyreiter, the lead counsels representing Brendan Dassey. Let me tell our listeners a little bit about our guests this week before we get into conversation with them. Steve Drizin is a clinical professor of law at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law's Bloom Legal Clinic, and he's a former legal director of the Clinic Center on Wrongful Convictions. In 2008, he founded the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth, which is the first innocence organization focused exclusively on righting the wrongful convictions of youthful defendants. At the CWCY, which is once again the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth, Steve and his colleagues helped exonerate more than a dozen men and women who have falsely confessed. His policy work focuses on supporting efforts around the country to require law enforcement agencies to electronically record custodial interrogations and to provide legal counsel for children during interrogations. Steve is a nationally recognized expert on the subject of false confessions, and he's lectured throughout the U.S., Canada, and Japan. Steve's scholarship in the area of interrogations and confessions, in fact, has been cited by the U.S. Supreme Court and numerous federal and state appellate courts. Now we turn to Laura Nyreiter. Laura is a clinical assistant professor of law and co-director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth at the same place, Northwestern Pritzker School of Law in Chicago. And Laura represents individuals who were wrongfully convicted of crimes when they were children or teenagers. In addition to her courtroom work, Laura regularly publishes scholarly and practitioner-focused articles on interrogations and post-conviction relief. And in partnership with the International Association of the Chiefs of Police, she's co-authored one of the only existing juvenile interrogation protocols. She's a frequent presenter on interrogations at defender and law enforcement training conferences around the country, and she's been featured in film and television programs on interrogations. Now, Laura happens to be a former student of Steve's, and now both of them have been representing Brendan Dassey since October 2007. And interestingly, Laura also represented Damian Eccles of the West Memphis 3 case. His case was profiled in the documentary West of Memphis, as well as other documentary and feature films. Both of their works on Brendan's case has been featured in episode 10 of the Netflix documentary Making a Murderer, and they also will be featured very prominently in the sequel. So, hi to both of you, and thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rabia. Thanks so much for having us.
It's really a pleasure.
So I want to refresh our listeners' memories a little bit about the case. I mean, this was Making a Murderer just kind of blew up on the scene when it released. I binge-watched it. A lot of folks watched it. But just to kind of refresh the memory of our listeners about, you know, can you explain Brendan's connection to this case? Because the murder of Teresa Halbach, I mean, the person who people debate whether or not is responsible is Stephen Avery. So who is Brendan to this case? How did he get involved?
So Brendan is Stephen Avery's nephew. And Teresa Halbach disappeared while visiting the salvage yard where Stephen Avery worked in October of 2005. It was Halloween evening, 2005. And over the next 10 or 11 days, the police cordoned off the property, did a number of searches, and found evidence that they thought was sufficient to charge Stephen Avery with her murder. But they didn't have a narrative of how she may have died. The evidence didn't tell a story. And so as they were preparing for Stephen Avery's trial, they interviewed Brendan Dassey, who had told police that he was with Stephen Avery for parts of the evening of Halloween. They had together built a bonfire, which was something that was quite common at the Avery salvage yard. That's how they burned trash. They were in an unincorporated part of Manitowoc County, and bonfires were a regular occurrence. So they interviewed Brendan four times over a three-day period.
How old was he at the time?
He was 16 years old when the police began interviewing him about this case. This was in February of 2006, right at the end of February 2006. So this is, you know, 4 or 5 months after the police had arrested Stephen Avery. And like Steve said, they're looking for a narrative to tell them what had happened in this case. And they come to settle on the idea of questioning Brendan Dassey. So Brendan's 16 years old, youngest of four boys, all of whom live next door to Stephen Avery with their mom. And he's intellectually and cognitively impaired. His IQ was measured at around 65. He's got social limitations, difficulty with vocabulary, and extreme suggestibility, more suggestible than 95% of the population. He was in special ed at school. He's a 10th grader. So what happened in February of 2006 is the police come to Brendan's high school around lunchtime, pull him out of the cafeteria, bring him to a room up front near the school office, and two adult seasoned police two-on-one about this bonfire that he'd been at for about an hour, maybe less than an hour, on the night of October 31st at his uncle's house. And they're questioning him. This is on audio tape, so we do have a record of exactly how this unfolded. And what they end up saying to Brendan is that the district attorney is looking at charging Brendan unless Brendan can tell them something, which we believe is totally untrue. There was no evidence at all linking Brendan to anything nefarious at this stage of the game. But they tell him this, and they tell him that they believed he had seen something in that bonfire. They told him, "Brendan, we know you saw a hand, a foot, a head, something in that fire." This goes on and on. And what does Brendan eventually do? You know, highly suggestible, intellectually impaired kid ends up saying, yes, I saw fingers, toes, and a forehead in that fire. Same body parts that they'd suggested.
Very odd.
Right. Really, really strange story. They get this from Brendan at the high school. They bring him to a police department. They put him in an interrogation room. They get him to repeat the story on videotape. Also, at this time, they suggest to him that his uncle had raped Ms. Halbach. And Brendan says, you know, he sort of hears the suggestion and acknowledges it. And then they get him to repeat these things on tape, and then they let him go later on, the next morning, actually. And they come back to him 2 days later on March 1st. They come back to him, back to his school, pull him out of school again, and this time they drive him 45 minutes away to another police department, the Manitowoc Police Department. They put him in an interrogation room there, this time on camera, and they question him for about 3.5 hours, again, without a parent or lawyer present, in a very suggestive manner, telling him that they knew he knew more than what he'd said before, telling him that they knew he was afraid of being arrested, but that the only way he'd be set free would be if he was honest with them. If he was honest with them, then everything would be all right. He'd be okay. He's got nothing to worry about. But by the way, Brendan, we know we'll only accept a certain story as honesty, right? Honesty means you know more than what he told us. And little by little, details about what they think Brendan did dribbled out over the course of this interrogation until Brendan finds himself repeating those details and admitting to raping and murdering Teresa Halbach along with his uncle.
He said, yeah, do you want to try it, though? Like, not right now. He just kept on egging me on.
Okay, and did he say anything else to you when he was egging you on? How did he egg you on?
He's like, come on, try it for me.
As the mother of a 15-month-old baby, I can tell you that there's nothing more important in my life than getting a good night's sleep. And getting a good night's sleep is easier and more affordable than you actually think. You don't even need to get a new expensive mattress or use sleeping pills. You just need to change your sheets. That's why you should check out Boll & Branch. Everything Boll & Branch makes, from their bedding to blankets, is made from pure 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and they get even softer over time. And you can buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. You get luxury sheets that cost up to $1,000 in the store, but Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple $100. And everyone who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of 5-star reviews. Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and Fast Company, they're all talking about Boll & Branch, but most importantly, I love Boll & Branch. Shipping is free and you can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back for a refund. But I doubt that you'll want to send them back because you will be sleeping better than you ever have in your life. There's no risk and no reason not to give them a try. To get you started right now, our listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com using the promo code undisclosed. Once again, that's bollandbranch.com to get $50 off your first set of sheets with the promo code undisclosed. B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code undisclosed. So he confesses, essentially.
He confesses. And I think what's telling to me are a couple of things. In the first interrogation at the school, the investigators did something that no police officer should ever do. They told a 16-year-old impaired kid, Brendan, you know that we're cops, but I'm not a cop right now. I want to come over there and give you a hug. I'm a father. I can see that you're hurting.
Oh, wow. It's very coercive.
Extremely coercive and misleading and untrue. And at the very end of the interrogation, after Brendan has confessed, after he has said, can I go back to school for my 6th period project, and asks about school a second time, the first thing the investigator says to Brendan is, Well, you know, Brendan, you know we're cops. I've never seen that happen in an interrogation. Since when do you have to tell anybody you've interrogated over 3 days, you have to remind them that you're cops? That's insane. That's the ground rule that most normal people would understand within a few minutes of being interrogated.
You know, I'm a parent and I have kids in school, and I'm also a little bit confused about how the police, number one, were able to get the school administrators to say, yeah, I'll go ahead, pick up this kid from class or lunchroom and, you know, do whatever you need. And was this just a way to bypass parental consent? I mean, does that happen? Is that allowed? Is there a legal challenge to how they even did that?
There's not a legal challenge. The failure to have a parent present during an interrogation is just one factor in assessing whether the end result of the confession is a voluntary confession or not. Some courts place some weight on the absence of a parent, but unfortunately, too many courts give police officers a pass. So it's a risk that police officers are willing to take. With regard to that first interrogation, there was even no effort to make contact with Brendan's mother. And the school officials readily gave him up to these investigators and never even contacted his mother.
Wow.
The second interrogation, there is some dispute, the one on March 1st, about what they told his mother, Barb, about, you know, what they were going to do with Brendan. She was in court all day. She had some proceedings with her divorce, so they knew that she was going to be unable to be there. And they took him 45 minutes away from where she was going to be. And they actually used her absence against Brendan by saying that his mother had told them that Brendan would be cooperative and would tell them what they wanted to hear.
Wow. So now that they have gotten their confession, my question is, did the police attempt to corroborate that confession anyway? Was there any evidence to back up? You know, you talk about the bonfire. My recollection is Ms. Halbach's remains weren't really found, or were pieces found? I mean, like, I thought that it was never, her body was actually never found. So how did they even attempt to find evidence to back up his confession?
So the corroboration question is a really good one and a really interesting and important one. Ms. Halbach's body was found about a week or a week and a half after her disappearance. Her remains were discovered in a bonfire pit that was located outside behind Stephen Avery's garage. It appeared as though she had been essentially cremated in that bonfire pit, and the remains were very, very small cremains and bone fragments that were discovered in that pit. Really, really a gruesome discovery. But what was interesting is, you know, these remains were recovered in November 2005, and they were sent to the Wisconsin State Crime Lab, as you can imagine, that analyzed these remains, trying to find out what they could, again, trying to create the narrative of what had happened to Ms. Halbach. And what's really interesting, okay, so you recall that Brendan was questioned first at the high school on February 27th, and then the next time, 2 days later, on March 1st, that's when he was interrogated and actually confessed. But there's a day in the middle there, February 28th, which is a really important day for this corroboration aspect. Because on that day, February 28th, the police, Brendan's interrogators, the lead investigators on this case, received a report from the Wisconsin Crime Lab that had been analyzing these remains. And for the first time, they looked at this report. For the first time, they saw that the crime lab had determined that one of these little bone fragments was a portion of Ms. Halbach's skull, and it bore markings consistent with a bullet entry wound, beveling and traces of lead and so on. So for the first time on February 28th, the police knew that she had been shot in the head. And this was non-public information that only the police and the true killer knew. So this is why the next day they go right back to Brendan with this crucial piece of information, brand new piece of information. And the idea is, let's get Brendan to say he knows she was shot in the head. Let's see if he can produce this information. And so if viewers of Making a Murderer will recall, during this interrogation on March 1st, they are very focused on asking Brendan how Teresa Halbach was killed.
And then you said that he went and got a gun, right?
Yeah.
And he came back in. What did he do?
He shot her 10 times.
Tell me where he shot her.
Like in the head and in the belly and stomach.
How many times did he shoot her in the head?
Like 3 times.
Tell me where in the head. What sides?
Like the left side, I think it was.
The left side of her head. And when he shot her in the body, where in the body again?
Like right here.
Okay.
But it was disastrous, if I recall. It didn't go well for the police.
They botched it. You're exactly right. They totally botched it, right? So Brendan provides guess after guess after guess. You know, he tries to suggest she was punched. She was stabbed. You know, they say, no, Brendan, come on, something with the head, right? They're giving him hints. Come on, Brendan, something with the head. And he's guessing, choking, you know, what about, you know, we cut off her hair. You know, I mean, he's really like grasping at straws here until they finally have to say to him, you know, come on, Brendan, I'm just going to come out and ask you, who shot her in the head? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he says, well, it's my uncle. And they say, Brendan, you know, why didn't you just tell us that? And he says, because I couldn't think of it.
Because I couldn't think of it. I mean, if you shot somebody in the head, or if you witnessed it, that would be the first thing that you would remember.
Right. And that's his language, is not that I couldn't remember it, but that I couldn't think of it. He couldn't come up with it.
He couldn't come up with it.
Exactly.
So you asked about corroboration. Okay, so remember, Brendan describes this awful scenario where she... Teresa is tied down in a bed, and she's punched and she's stabbed, and she's sexually assaulted in the trailer of Stephen Avery's bedroom of Stephen Avery's trailer. Talks about her being carried out towards the garage. First, he says she was shot outside the garage, and the police officers lead him to the garage. And then he also talks about accompanying Stephen to drive the car to a remote area of the salvage yard lot and covering it with branches. So we're talking about multiple crime scenes here, right? You've got the trailer, you've got Teresa's car, you've got the area where the car is left, you've got the garage. They tore up that trailer. They ripped paneling off the walls. They dug deep down into the concrete. They found no blood, no hair, no DNA of Brendan's anywhere, no trace of Teresa anywhere in that bedroom. They found no trace of Brendan in the car, on the car, and they found no evidence of Brendan anywhere in the garage. After the confession that they obtained on March 1st, they did another search of the garage. It's one of many searches they had done of the garage. And they claimed to locate a bullet that had Teresa's DNA on it. But Brendan didn't lead them to the garage. They led Brendan to the garage. So that's not corroboration of anything.
And in fact, they had long suspected that she'd been shot in the garage, because during their early searches back in November of 2005, they'd found 10 or 11 shell casings in the garage and had suspected that her vehicle had been hidden in the garage. So, you know, they thought she'd been shot in the garage for quite a while. And so in the interrogation, they lead him to say, yes, you shot her in the head and it happened in the garage. And then lo and behold, their own theory is corroborated. But, you know, the maddening thing in all of this, I mean, it's all maddening, but one maddening thing is then, you know, come the time of trial, you've got the state stand up at closing argument and say, innocent people don't confess, right? And they stand up and say, the reason you can believe this confession, the reason you, jury, can have confidence that this kid did these horrific things is because he knew she was shot in the head. And that's what the evidence showed. It's corroborated. Right. You know, I mean, it's just completely backwards.
Let me tell you guys something. I travel way more than I wish I did, but my life and my travels have been made so much easier ever since I got a piece of beautiful Away luggage. Once I got this carry-on, that's it. I turned to no other carry-on. This is my go-to bag. I can put so much in there. It's got such incredible features. All their suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate. It's unrivaled in strength. This thing is so strong. My baby, my kids hop up and down on it. It's perfectly fine, but it's so lightweight. On the inside, they have this patent-pending compression system. Believe me, it can help if you're an overpacker. I can't even tell you. I can pack an entire week's worth of stuff in this bag. It's got 360-degree spinner wheels, which I love. I love because you're not struggling with trying to get the bag to go in the right direction. It's always going in the same direction as you. The bag has a built-in TSA-approved combination lock. And get this, it has a phone charger right there. Both sizes of Away carry-on bags are able to charge all cell phones, tablets, e-readers, anything else that's powered by a USB cord. A single charge of the Away carry-on will charge your iPhone, get this, 5 times. And the Away bag has a lifetime warranty. If anything breaks, they will fix it or replace it for you for life. You can also start off, though, with a 100-day trial. Live with it, vibe with it, travel with it, Instagram it, and if at any point you decide it's not for you, just return it for a full refund. No questions asked. It also makes a really sweet gift for any traveler in your life. Either way, whether it's for you or for somebody in your world who does a lot of globetrotting, well, you get a special deal if you're an Undisclosed listener. $20 off a suitcase, all you have to do is visit awaytravel.com/undisclosed and use the promo code undisclosed during checkout. Once again, you'll get $20 off either one of their carry-on size suitcases by going to awaytravel.com/undisclosed and using the promo code undisclosed during checkout. It's first class luggage at a coach price. Away luggage. Luggage with power. Well, you know, one of the most shocking things to me about, and you see these scenarios kind of play out again and again in different iterations when it comes to wrongful convictions, especially when youth are involved, is that it's so clear. I mean, I'm a layperson, and when I watched that interrogation, I was like, it's so obvious. He doesn't know anything about any of this, and he's just giving the police what he thinks they need to hear for so he can go back to school. I can see this. I never understand, like, how do the police not see it? They know that they're feeding the guy, this kid, information. What is happening there? Is this there? Is this an act of desperation to get their conviction? Is it real misconduct? Is it that they really believe this kid is, like, faking them out? I never understand how these professionals don't see what they're doing or what's happening right in front of their eyes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate question in these cases. And I think this is what happens is we're talking about tunnel vision, right? I mean, they have a theory. They thought from the very beginning that there was a sexual component to this crime because Stephen Avery had some previous sexual allegations made against him. And so they entered that interrogation room with a theory. And they pushed and pushed and pushed that theory on a mentally impaired child and finally got him to confirm their theory. Now, you would hope that by looking at this tape, in preparing for trial, the prosecutor and the police officers would have recognized what you and millions of others of people saw. It's the same thing I saw, and it's the same thing that Laura saw when I assigned her this case as a student in 2007.
That's right.
There is something very wrong with this interrogation, and you shouldn't be able to trust anything that this kid is saying. But they didn't see that because they didn't want to see it, because they needed Brendan in order to convict Stephen, and they needed that narrative to taint both Brendan and Stephen in the eyes of the jurors.
Was Brendan ever offered a plea deal to testify against his uncle?
You know, I think there were plea discussions that were happening well before Brendan's trial. But, you know, that was all occurring around the time of Brendan's representation by a man named Len Kaczynski, who viewers of Making a Murderer will remember as the lawyer who...
Horrified by, right?
Yeah, completely made everybody jump off their couches and, you know, say, what is this? What's going on? The guy who sold out his own client, right? Who tried, worked to incriminate his own client.
So Brendan was then convicted and sentenced to what?
Life in prison with the first chance of parole in 2048.
Essentially 42 years before he's eligible for parole, you know, in a parole system where, you know, it's not anything close to assured he would be paroled.
So both of you made an appearance on the original series. So, and I'm just curious how you became involved in Brendan's case. Did it come to the center? Is that how you both took it on? Or
in October of 2007, I was sitting in my office and the phone rang. And on the other end of the phone were a group of people who I had worked with before in Wisconsin. There was the director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project. There was a homicide, you know, public defender in Milwaukee. There was a, you know, a woman who I had worked on a juvenile confession case in Wisconsin before. It was actually the case that led Wisconsin to require that all interrogations and confessions be recorded. And they asked me if I would take Brendan's case. And, you know, I felt compelled to say yes, especially after I saw that videotape. So we've been representing Brendan since 2007, all on appeal.
And I was, you know, when Steve got that call 11 years ago, I was a 3L at Northwestern Law. Destined, I thought, for a life as a commercial litigator. And I had signed up for Steve's clinical class my 3L year. And
you're doomed that, ever since.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, there goes the rest of my life, right? I mean, knowing nothing about criminal law, or very little about criminal law, knowing nothing about false confessions. And I happened to be the nearest student when Steve got assigned Brendan's case. And, you know, first thing he did was he handed me the videotapes of Brendan's March 1st interrogation, the same tapes that the world saw on Making a Murderer. And I took these things home. I sat on my couch, put them into my laptop, and watched this interrogation as a 3L. And I was heartbroken at what I saw. And I knew this, you know, that we were the ones to work to make this better, that there was a moral imperative here. And, you know, that was it. That was it for me.
We didn't contact the filmmakers. In fact, we didn't really even know about them when we showed up in Manitowoc, Wisconsin in 2010 for our post-conviction hearing. And there were, I like to describe them as sort of scruffy women wearing, you know, whatever mismatched winter clothing they could cobble together in sub-freezing Manitowoc, Wisconsin, in the courtroom with a camera. And they had been there for years filming everything in Stephen Avery's case. And to be honest with you, it was terrifying. I mean, we don't have cameras in our courtroom in Illinois. This is the first time we had ever tried a case in front of cameras. But they were, you know, they were persistent. You know, we sort of forgot they were there after a while. We thought this was a done deal, right? We thought that this film that they had put together was never going to be made. They had thousands of hours of footage, and year after year went by, 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, and then as a result of the success of the Serial podcast, they had gold in their hands, right? They had a video of a trial and a lot of people who they had interviewed throughout the process. But it was still up to them to cull through thousands of hours of footage to produce something, a docuseries. And, you know, that landed in December of 2015 and just took off. They did a brilliant job.
Well, I'll be honest, you know, there has been a documentary team working on Adnan's case for the last couple of years, almost, I think, 3 years now, I can't remember, but it was not easy, has not been easy always convincing his attorney to be comfortable with, yeah, I mean, I understand that. I mean, like, you're both tasked with protecting your client, and most attorneys are very media shy when it comes to their cases. So how was that experience for you? Did you kind of resist this process being filmed, especially not knowing what was going to happen with it?
Well, you know, without getting too much into it, obviously what we did was, you know, everything we did was in consultation with our client and with his blessing, obviously. But, you know, like Steve said, it sort of faded into the background for us. You know, we never thought this project, well, you know, we had no idea it was going to go anywhere, to be honest. So it faded into the background in this space, in doing wrongful convictions work. You know, these stories, all of them are so compelling. It's not uncommon for somebody to want to, you know, see if they can make a film or do an interview or write a story or whatever about these incredible stories. So it's sort of like, well, you know, they're fading in the background. They're not getting in our way. Our client's okay with it. Let's just move forward. And, you know, then comes December 2015 and it's, you know, about 7,000 times bigger than we ever thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. Well, Laura, you also worked on the Damien Eccles case, and that, I mean, the West Memphis Three, that's had media attention for a very, very long time. I think I watched every film and documentary ever made about it for years. And in both of these cases, it seems like the attention that they got on a more public scale did help the case. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
You know, I think that part of the task in any wrongful conviction case is to just provide a context in which minds can begin to be changed by the evidence in the case, right? And sometimes just pushing back against the narrative that's already out there, you know, West Memphis Three are child killers, Brendan Dassey is a rapist and murderer. Sometimes just pushing back on that narrative enough to create an openness for people to take a second look, you know, that's important. It can be, at least, really important. So, you know, that's how we approach it.
Well, you know, it was interesting when I watched the West Memphis Three documentaries. Damien comes across as very self-assured. I mean, he's also young, but he seems very, very self-assured. He's very different from Brendan. I mean, in terms of, it seems like their cognitive abilities, it's so clear that Brendan has impairments, whereas Damien doesn't come across like that at all. He, and in fact, that's what made it a little bit hard to assess whether or not his confession was false. So my question to you is, how do you know if it is false? If you have a defendant like Damien Eccles.
So Damien actually did not confess. It was his co-defendant, Jesse Miss Kelly, who is another Brendan Dassey. Jesse was a
actually,
teenager.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, he was a teenager, cognitive disabilities. Same story, different day.
The truth is that most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Next, Quip subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They deliver new brush heads in a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They're on Oprah's O List, named one of Time's best inventions, and the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day. Now, I'm one of those users. I used to overbrush and not change my brush heads quickly enough. And Quip has solved both of those problems. And now they can solve your problems too. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/undisclosed right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/undisclosed. Spelled GETQUIP.com/undisclosed.
Both of you have for years been doing wrongful conviction work, and also specifically with youth. Can you talk a little bit about, like, are there general patterns, like common red flags that you see in these cases?
Yeah, there are a lot of red flags. All of them were present in Brendan's case. We know that young people are more vulnerable to police pressure than adults, and we know that they are overrepresented in every sample of false confessions. They're much more likely than adults are to falsely confess. And what you see in these cases, especially if you're lucky enough to have a videotape of the process, is that the confession, the final end product confession, is more parts police than it is suspect. There's a process of fact feeding that occurs because the innocent person can't come up with the details on their own. And it's usually done through leading questions or forced choice questions that give the suspect only two choices, and the suspect guesses correctly. Or if he doesn't guess correctly, then more leading questions lead him to the answer that police officers want to see. It's very common in these cases involving juveniles that the suspect who confesses recants very quickly after confessing when they meet a parent or an attorney. And it's also common that these juvenile suspects actually think that they're going to go home or go back to school. You have a population of people who have different ways of making decisions than adults, both because of their lack of life experience and because of their immature brain development. That makes it more likely that they will say whatever it is the police officers want to hear from them in order to bring the stress and the pressure to an end and in order to get out of that interrogation room. With someone like Brendan, who is socially awkward, immature, disabled in the social sphere, even talking to somebody, an adult, for 3 hours is like psychological torture.
So, Steve, you founded the Center for Wrongful Conviction of Youth. And Laura, are you both co-directors right now? Or
I'm no longer the co-director. I've given that over to Laura and another colleague named Megan Crane.
But can you guys tell us a bit about the center and the work it's done?
Absolutely. So Steve founded the center here at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law in 2009. So we're coming up on our 10th anniversary. And it was,
wow.
Yeah, I know. And we were, it was dedicated to the idea that children are more likely to be wrongfully convicted, particularly more likely to falsely confess during police interrogation than adults. And since our founding almost 10 years ago now, we've been fortunate enough to help exonerate or secure the release of over 20 individuals, all of whom were involved in wrongful convictions that happened to them when they were children or adolescents.
That's incredible.
Yeah, our work, spans the country. We take these cases after they've been convicted, sometimes years after they've been convicted, and they come to us all different ways. Sometimes inmates write to us directly. Sometimes we get telephone calls from, a public defender on the other side of the country who just says, it was 20 years ago, but I can't get this client out of my head because I know he's innocent. The kind of phone call that sends chills up your spine. And sometimes we read about a story in the paper where there's a false confession defense from a juvenile, and we reach out and try to learn more and try to think if it's some case in which we can provide some support, some help to the team. So we've done our work all kinds of different ways, and we've been fortunate enough to not only represent and clear these folks, but also use their stories as a platform for changing the law and changing the practice around interrogations. We work with law enforcement. That's one of the things that I'm most proud of that we've done. We work with law enforcement trainers, folks who train police in all 50 states, to develop new ways of interrogating kids that reduce the risk of falsely confessing. We've worked with the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and we've also worked with Wicklander Zulawski, which is the second leading interrogation training firm in the country, who's actually filed briefs in Brendan's case, saying that they now use his interrogation video to train police how not to interrogate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's exciting to see the change happening. And, you know, this is something we're really dedicated to.
Millions, tens of millions, I don't know, maybe hundreds of millions of people watch the Netflix series. Not everybody has kept up on Brendan's case since then. But I remember being on a panel with Steve, I think about a year and a half ago, and I remember you telling me that you had just gotten off the phone with Brendan and you were literally preparing for him to come home at the end of that week. I think this was like around Thanksgiving of 2016, if I'm remembering correctly. But a lot's happened since the series, and a lot's happened since that conversation with you. So could you kind of give us an update on procedurally the case, what's happening and what has happened in the last few years?
Well, I'll say is you know, we've been litigating this case for 10 years. And first we had to litigate it in the state courts. I actually, at the time, because I had won a false confession case in Wisconsin's Supreme Court, thought we had a great chance of winning. I thought that if the judges looked at this tape, they would have the same reaction that you and millions of other people had. What I didn't know was that the makeup of the Wisconsin Supreme Court would change dramatically between the time of the case that I won and the time that Brendan's case got to that court, and change in ways that made it virtually impossible for Brendan to get relief. As it turned out, we lost in the intermediate appellate courts, and then the Wisconsin Supreme Court refused to even take the case. So when you and I were on that panel, we had been litigating in federal court, where we won in the federal district court on a writ of habeas corpus. And then we sought bond. We sought to get Brendan out pending his appeal in the Seventh Circuit. And we won. The federal district court, you know, agreed to release Brendan. You know, media trucks were surrounding the prison, and we managed Brendan's expectations because we knew that nothing was final. And the Seventh Circuit entered a stay of the district court judge's order until they had an opportunity to hear an appeal of Brendan's writ of habeas corpus grant in the district court. So Brendan was never released. And we then won in the federal, in the first round in the Seventh Circuit in a 2-1 decision. And then the court took en banc review, which means the entire court reviews the decision of the panel.
Is that at the request of the state, or is that?
Yeah, I mean, we knew the state was going to push this case, you know, as far as it could go. And we also knew that we were going to push it to the Supreme Court if we lost in that en banc review. And we did. We lost 4-3 in a, you know, a decision that still keeps me up at night. But we lost by one vote, and one of the judges that we had hoped would be on the court retired a few weeks before the court was argued. And so now we're in the U.S. Supreme Court.
What is the status before the Supreme Court? You filed cert? You're asking the Supreme Court to, or have they taken the appeal yet?
Yeah, we've got a cert petition pending, and this has been a process that's really, you know, been since we have to go through it. We're so happy that it's gone the way it's gone. We've been joined on the cert petition by former U.S. Solicitor General Seth Waxman and his team of appellate attorneys at WilmerHale in D.C. So they've been instrumental on the cert petition that raises not only the involuntariness of Brendan's confession, but that shines light on a widespread national problem that involves the courts not applying longstanding law that's supposed to be protective of kids like Brendan in the interrogation room. I mean, that's the ironic thing here. There have been Supreme Court cases on the books for decades instructing courts to evaluate cases like Brendan's with special care, to pay attention, to give careful weight to things like the absence of a parent and fact feeding, promises of leniency, all these things. But courts are way too often misapplying or just ignoring this law. And you can see it in cases around the country. So the cert petition is saying, you know, look, do this for Brendan, but do it for the other Brendans, for the other kids around the country, the many other kids around the country who are not being protected by our courts. So we've got a cert petition pending. It's been supported at the cert stage by six amicus briefs filed by some of the leading Supreme Court litigators in D.C., Lisa Blatt of Arnold & Porter, Beth Brinkman of Covington. Several other firms have contributed their time, which has been spectacular to watch. And the briefs have been filed by, you know, heavy hitters, the American Psychological Association, talking about the psychology of the interrogation room, law enforcement training organizations, talking about how, you know, Brendan's interrogation is emblematic of how not to question juveniles, a group of prosecutors talking about, you know, no justice-minded individual wants to see a case like this happen, and that the appearance of justice in a high-profile case like this can sometimes be as important as justice itself, you know, a consideration that's out there. And also briefs filed by a group of juvenile false confessors, people who themselves have been through similar situations to Brendan, a group of juvenile justice legal experts, and a group of law professors.
Most of these groups do not weigh in at the cert stage. That's what makes this so unusual. You know, they will say, we'll be glad to help you once the Supreme Court accepts cert.
Right.
The American Psychological Association, I think, maybe has done this once in their history other than in Brendan's case. So we are so thrilled with the level of support we've gotten, with the amount of pro bono hours law firms have donated, with the fact that law enforcement and interrogation trainers have weighed in on this. You know, we've positioned ourselves in Brendan's case in the best way possible, and now we wait.
I mean, it's such an egregious example of this issue, and it's video. I mean, we can see it with our own eyes. I'm really happy to see, like, the outpouring support you've gotten from so many heavy hitters and professionals. And I'm assuming all of that, you know, the Supreme Court will take into consideration about how long will it take for them to decide whether or not they're going to accept the case. And then what would that mean? What would happen after that?
So they were supposed to conference the case on the 14th of June. They rescheduled that conference until the 21st of June. So they'll be meeting on Thursday about the case. You know, it's possible they could relist the case for another conference, or they could make a decision between Thursday and, say, Monday of next week. You know, if they accept the case, then we do another round of briefing, and we expand the amicus pool. And then the case would be argued sometime, you know, I suppose, in the fall if we get accepted.
That's an oral argument I will be at. I can promise you that.
Yeah, there'll be a long line to get into that.
I'm sure. I'll just tag in with you, Steve. No problem. No, I'm kidding. Well, you know, so one of the things that is really bothersome is, you know, what I asked you not too long ago is how the states keep fighting to keep these convictions. I mean, when you got the news that, you know, he was going to be released, it seemed like, I thought at this point the state's going to say, you know what, okay, maybe we'll offer a plea deal. Maybe we're just going to drop all of this. I don't understand always why that happens. But in this case, you know, it's not just Brendan's conviction. There's also Stephen Avery's conviction that I'm guessing the state is thinking about. And in Avery's case, you know, he's being represented right now by Kathleen Zellner, a very high profile attorney. What impact are the two cases having on each other at this point, or do they have any?
Well, they've been largely separate up until this point in time. You know, Brendan's case is all about the confession and the interrogation and, you know, interpreting what occurred on that tape. And it's all there on tape, right? Stephen's case has been a forensic case, and so Kathleen's work has been in hiring experts to challenge some of the forensic findings that were used to convict Stephen's. Brendan's confession was never admitted in Stephen's case, although it clearly tainted the jury pool, as did a press conference that occurred after Brendan's arrest in which his confession was broadcast widely. So the cases have really taken different paths to this date. You know, whether they converge at some point in the future remains to be seen. But right now there's been separation.
So you guys have been in, it seems like you're pretty deeply involved with the kind of the sequel or the second season of Making a Murder. I mean, like the appellate process, Brendan's appellate process is going to be pretty thoroughly covered.
I think that's fair to say.
Any kind of hint you can give us about when that's expected to air? Do you guys know at all?
I don't know.
My final question to you both is, how is Brendan? I'm just so heartbroken that this young man is in prison. I don't even know if he understands the gravity of this situation, given his capacity, but I'm sure being away from his family all these years has been incredibly difficult in all of them. How is he doing?
Well, it has been. It has been difficult. That's exactly right, Rabia, as you can imagine. But, you know, how's he doing? What can I say? He's hanging in there, trying to get through each day with hope and positivity, you know, waiting like all of us are to find out his fate. So he's hanging in there.
I mean, the eyes of the nation, if not more than that, are going to be on this case. If the Supreme Court does not grant cert, what happens then?
We will convene and do what good lawyers do and brainstorm. That's what happens next.
You don't give up fighting, though. That part I understand. I know how that is. Well, I want to thank you both for joining me today. Honestly, I mean, all the best wishes for your work with Brendan's case and all the other work you do. And I want to urge our listeners to support your work. So if you don't mind telling us where our listeners can find more information about the center and how they can support your work, that'd be great.
Absolutely. For anyone who wants to learn more about our work or find out a way to support us, they can just go to our website, www.cwcy.org.
How can they support you guys? Can they donate? What can they do?
Yep. On our website, there's links for folks who want to make donations. You can just do that right online.
Awesome. That's great. I'm sure our listeners will do that. And finally, how can our listeners find you guys online so they can continue to follow your work and this case and just maybe say hello?
So we are on our own website, cwcy.org. We're also on the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law website, and we're active on Twitter and Facebook. So
yeah, I can't believe Laura is actually active on Twitter now. You can't imagine how hard it was for me to get her to work on the Twitter stuff.
Terrifying. You made me do it.
Yeah, don't underestimate the power of Twitter. Let's get your Twitter handles before we sign off.
I'm Laura Nyreiter.
And I'm at S Drizzen.
Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate you being on. I know a decision for Brendan is not far from now, and you know, only good thoughts. Only good thoughts.
Thank you so much.
So many thanks.
Many of our listeners have been asking about when we are going to be covering another wrongful conviction case in depth. And guess what? It's right around the corner. In 2 weeks' time, Undisclosed will be back with a brand new, long series about a wrongful conviction case in which a double murder was committed in front of over half a dozen people. And yet, somehow, they still managed to get the wrong guy. Next time on Undisclosed.